Hi, and welcome to another episode of Center Nation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz in beautiful, rainy Portland.
Hey, everybody, I'm Thomas Horton.
And I'm Hunter Blackrock in the city of Gotham.
So Hunter's in Atlanta.
I'm in Atlanta, not Gotham. Gotham is and a fake place.
Tom Hardy.
I've never watched a Batman movie.
Hunter, how excited are you about the Tom Hardy movie where he plays opposite himself?
Legend? I'm really excited of Legend. Like, the more I watch the trailer, the more I realize it's kind of everything I've ever wanted. So.
Plus, just like...
Yeah. If it was a Star Wars movie where he played himself twice, then that would be even better. But
what's
we'll
better than one
later.
Tom Hardy in a film?
Yeah.
Two.
Two Tom Hardys!
Two Tom Hardys in a film.
Oh, man.
Sorry, Tom Hardy. Now I must break you. Thanks, Tom Hardy.
I heard buzz that his performance in Legend could beat out Depp for a nomination.
I would believe that because I was not overly excited about Johnny Depp's Black Mass performance. It was great, but
I loved it.
It wasn't as great as I thought it was going to be.
I thought it was great. I mean, compared to what he's been doing recently, I thought it was some of his best work.
Well, I mean, yeah. Look at what he's done recently. It's the best thing he's done recently.
Yeah.
Probably
since Sweeney Todd. Probably since Sweeney Todd.
I would argue Into the Woods.
What about Brandon? What about Tusk, though?
That's true. I'm not going to lie. Tusk was very different for him. And even though it was so outlandish and so crazy, I gotta give him props. Like, he was like the character actor Johnny Depp that he can play very, very well. That he doesn't get it. Like, he's just too much of a lead guy that he doesn't take those small roles anymore. But
yeah, I think maybe what Tuss just showed us is like maybe we don't need to like maybe Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland like shouldn't be focused on the Mad Hatter. Like, maybe we should get the Mad Hatter.
No,
like, let's not make him like a central character.
Well, that's
But everybody wants to see you know, Jack Sparrow everywhere.
I'm excited for him to come back as Jack Sparrow. Thank you very much.
I am too. But that's the big thing with certain stars. Once they get to a certain point, maybe they don't need to be the one carrying the film. Maybe they should be the ones like in the ensemble piece. And
you know who's like totally okay with doing that?
Who?
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
Let's not get in this tangent.
We'll literally talk about The Martian for an hour and a half.
Okay, actually, so to start this off, I'm going to ask you guys this, because this will probably lead into where our topic is. What all of y'all been watching recently? Movies, television shows?
Ooh, I know what I want to talk about.
Beast of No Nation.
What all have you been watching, guys? So,
Beast of No Nation in theaters.
I'll save. Okay, we'll save that for a little bit later.
Yeah.
I want to tell you about a show. Ben, I want to tell you about something that I think you would love if you haven't watched it already. It's called Documentary Now, and it's probably the greatest television show.
You know my love for Fred Armisen. I've discussed it here on the show previously.
Okay. The episode that my roommate Bryce and I started off with an episode called The Hunt for El Chingon, which is basically making fun of Vice News for about an hour. And Jack Black plays the leader of drones, which is like their version of Vice. And they use Vice as font and everything. It's like dead on making fun of Vice.
Amazing.
He's like eating Kobe beef on a stick. And then Fred Armisen and Bill Hader play different Vice reporters that end up going to Mexico to hunt down this drug cartel member. It's the greatest show. And then they made fun of, what was the old documentary about the Inuit?
Nanook of the North, is that what you're talking about?
Okay, they made fun of it with something called Canuck the Hunter, and it's just Fred Armisen playing an Inuit man in a silent documentary film. It's the greatest show of all time.
I heard they convinced a small town in Iceland to basically concoct an entire, like, what is it, like a festival, right? Did I hear this wrong? I haven't seen any of them yet, but I'm super excited about it.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. It wouldn't surprise me at all. It's one of the greatest things. At first, I'm wondering, like, did they film this on location? And then I'm like, oh, yeah, they totally did. They 100% did this.
I think what I love most about it is it completely represents my ideal of what I would love to do if I was just loaded with money and also a funny person, like someone who could make people laugh, is that you would just spend your money thank you, Hunter, but I'm not obscenely wealthy. You would just spend your money doing, like, really awesome jokes. Like, that's totally all they're doing. They're just like, we have money. And they don't even have to spend their own money, necessarily. They're convincing other people to back them to just have these ridiculous jokes. And I just think that's, like, the old... It's like a little bit of Bill Murray just walking up and, you know, telling jokes at people's weddings or things like that, where he's just doing it because he can. Like, no one's going to tell him no.
And then no one will believe him. After they tell the story that Bill Murray came and gave the toast at their wedding, no one believes them.
But just like you know, it still has some meaning, though, Hunter, even if you can't prove it to people on Facebook.
It does. Oh, no. I when I was at the Alabama, you won't believe this, I was at the Alabama Ole Miss game a couple weeks ago. He walked by us when I was with Jack Blankenship, and there's this huge crowd of people following him. And then this one girl goes, oh, my God, it's Bill Murray. And Jack goes, oh, my God, that really was Bill Murray. And I was like, this is the weirdest day of my life.
I remember when I used to get excited for Bill Murray sightings. Back in the day.
Oh, okay.
It was a great moment in my life. 4 years, and it was just like, oh, Bill Murray.
Okay. We're not here to talk about Bill Murray. Tell me what you've been watching, Thomas.
Well, I feel like this is something like Hunter and Brandon and hopefully Ben, if he'll go watch it, that we could all do an episode in defense of Steve Jobs. But I saw Steve Jobs and totally loved it and thought it deserved a better, definitely deserved a better box office reception. I was reading like some comments on Reddit today that were like, oh man, I can't believe they like spent money on another Steve Jobs biopic, and like somebody else is like, I didn't even realize there was already one, and somebody else was like, yeah, Ashton Kutcher, and everybody's just like, I'm so sick of Steve Jobs, like I'm so sick of these things building him up as a legend, and like that's not what this movie is at all. It's not a biopic. I don't feel like it puts itself out there as being like realistic at all. It's like Brandon said, it's a play. Like, it's done in three acts, and, like, it's set in the, like, half an hour before three of his major keynote speeches and just, like, backstage drama. Yeah. And so, yeah, it never felt like a biopic to me at all, and it also never feels like it's, like, building up Steve Jobs or, like, engaging in Steve Jobs
worship.
And
you honestly forget that it's Fassbender.
Yeah. Yeah,
he completely just embodies this character, and it is
mind-blowing. And also, like, I'm glad that you guys all liked it, or Hunter and Brandon, you guys liked it. Ben, I think you're gonna love it. But also, like, I was a little worried, like, as soon as I walked out of it, and I was like, oh my gosh, this was incredible. Like, my first thought was like, I'm just such a like unadulterated Sorkin fanboy that, you know, maybe nobody else will like it. But, yeah.
I think the most interesting reviews that I've heard so far are the comparisons to Citizen Kane, in the sense, not in its greatness necessarily, but in that it's basically taking a living figure, and in the case of Citizen Kane, giving it a different name so everyone knows who you're talking about, but you get the leeway of saying this isn't a direct, you know, copy of this person. We're talking about some of the broader things related to their life. But the issue with Steve Jobs is they are calling it Steve Jobs. They're not calling it, I don't know what you would, you know, pick along that analogy. But
yeah, and Steve Jobs is going off of like Fassbender, and it's Sorkin came out recently and said that like people talked about how Fassbender didn't look like Steve Jobs, but it wasn't about how he looked, but more about him embodying the character. And he made an interesting comment that I wish he went more into it. I don't think he did. He said, like, oh, if it was a few years ago, like, a young Denzel Washington could play this character. And I was like, to play Steve Jobs. And he was more saying, you didn't have to look like the character, but you had to embody the character. And that's what Fassbender did.
Brandon, I was thinking about was, like, and what you said goes straight to it. And as soon as we saw it in theaters, you said, you know, that was theater. That was a play that we just watched on camera.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It made me think of currently, like, the biggest thing on Broadway right now is Hamilton, which is watching Alexander Hamilton and Founding Fathers rapping and engaging in a musical, and yeah. it's played by multiple ethnicities of actors playing the Founding Fathers, so that's what I feel like the Steve Jobs movie is more like, is an artistic representation of these characters like that. And maybe, you know, if it was kind of advertised as something like that rather than a biopic, people would be more open to it. I don't know. But, like, people seem to be open to Hamilton, the musical.
The thing that I think that I love the most about the movie was more about the theme of, or the just the continuing, like, playing out of this dude, basically this man who never fixed problems that were going on in his life and just let all of this stuff accumulate over time while he was trying to, like, he's trying to make this thing and, like, change the future and be this icon, but his personal life and, like, literally every aspect, like his work, his family, his friends, even himself, like, everything was snowballing, and it took, like, reconciling a lot of that stuff, or, like, at least it coming to a head for him to really, like, the timing of it was almost beautiful. It was very well done, and it never seemed, for something that could have been really on the nose, it never seemed on the nose at all. Like, in
I was so, like, I didn't know much about it going into it, and I told Brandon, like, when I saw that, like, the whole thing was taking, like, backstage at these shows, I was just like, yes, because this is, like, this is Sorkin's home field. Like, this is where Aaron Sorkin, like, lives. Mm-hmm. It's, like, everybody running around getting ready for something big to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, it truly something special.
I mean, I've been following a lot of the press around the film, like, during production stuff, because I pretty much get camped. I'm a fanboy. I'm an Apple fanboy, partially from, you know, the work I do, but I've been a fanboy for years, and I kind of own up to it. But I think some of the press that's come out in the run-up to the film could explain some of the hesitation for people to go out, because, you know, his widow, Lauren Powell, right? Is her? I think that's her.
Yeah, because he's never married to the main.
Yeah,
but his widow with the several other children that he had later in life. With her, she was completely against the film and was very vocal about it, and pressed, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio and several of the other people who were considering the leading role and the studios that supported it to not make it at all. And a lot of the big name, Tim Cook, the, you know, current CEO of Apple, said that the whole film was opportunistic, and Sorkin got into a, you know, a little bit of
Tim Cook's an Auburn guy. Let's not forget that.
You know, he's still,
Anyway, yeah, continue.
And I think there is a, you know, because it, in a way, not to segue to Beasts of No Nation, but I think it's hard to get people out of their house to go see a film that they know is going to be, you know, kind of a downer. Like, there's nothing in the promotion of it that really says, like, this is going to make you feel great about humanity or anything like that. Because people know, if you know anything about Steve Jobs, you know that he was a complex, difficult person to work for. There's just stories all over the place, including the biography that the film's material is kind of sourced from. He did some very questionable things as a by what most people consider. So I don't know. I think the comparisons to Citizen Kane are interesting because I don't know. I don't know that I'm shocked that it did poorly in wide release. It seems like an art house film to begin with. You know, it doesn't necessarily seem like a film that rolls out to 3,000 screens and just fills up theaters.
Yeah,
I mean, $30 million budget is not an astronomical number for the cast they got and the production value.
I mean, it is. It's a fairly small production when you watch it. You know, a few sets. No, it is a very small starring cast. Like, yeah, it works.
No, I mean, I'm going off.
Released by Universal is a big deal. Like, I mean, Universal released it. That's a big studio film. And so, yeah, it is more of an art house type feel to it. I mean, but it's like it was released on a large scale.
Yeah, but I think the reason why you're not hearing as much about like, oh my god, it flopped, it's like the end of the world, is because it wasn't that big of a gamble. It wasn't that big of a
there is quite a bit of press that's coming out though of people talking about like why has it failed so badly in wide release. You know, it's what, fifth at the box office this past weekend, behind several other films.
It'll find a way to make it.
Yeah, I was about to say.
No,
maybe
I'm not worried about it financially. I think
for drawing all these Citizen Kane parallels, you know, maybe it'll just have a lot of longevity. And
yeah, because Steve Jobs is a film that we watched it, I think, a week ago, Thomas, and like that's the one I honestly think about daily since coming out of it. Like I saw Bridge of Spies and that one like back to back. Bridge of Spies, solid movie, but Steve Jobs still has me thinking about like almost like I want to go see that again. Because it still has that effect on me.
Well, it's got that Sorkin layering, man. You know,
I think that's where the longevity is going to come from. I think if you take Social Network, Steve Jobs, and then let's say Sorkin just out of nowhere does an Elon Musk biopic, that trilogy is going to last forever.
Calling it early. He's calling it early, people.
Dude, I'm calling it early. Don't be shocked when Aaron Sorkin's like, I think I'm going to write an Elon Musk SpaceX a biopic.
Dude, and that's a story that I'm very interested in. Aaron,
if you're listening, we all approve. You do it.
We greenlight your film that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
We'll go see it. There's at least like $30.
But yeah, I'm going to segue into this because this is kind of a topic. It's kind of a correlation to it, but... in the Deadline article by Netflix, Ted Sarandos,
he's a Netflix cop,
talked
Chief
about
original
on,
program.
Did an interview with Deadline about Beast of No Nation and how they released the info that it's been seen by over 3 million viewers so far, on Netflix. But it did not do well at all in theaters because all the theaters boycotted it pretty much. 31 theaters screened it. I think it made, was it like $50,000? It was a very
Yeah, the per
low,
theater
like
earnings
low
are shockingly
the
low.
Yeah, and he talks about the, or Deadline asked about things like how Steve Jobs and The Walk, another film that's gotten great, great reviews, but it didn't find an audience in the theaters, and would say something like Steve Jobs or The Walk, would they benefit from, say, an online release like Beast of No Nation? What are y'all's thoughts on that?
Well, I mean,
I thought there was really the only reason why they even put Beast of No Nation in theaters is to meet that Oscar qualification. There's not yes. a they weren't trying to make money off of it. That's the least of their concerns. The what they want to do is get a movie that gets Oscar attention that they've done, which honestly, I would argue, I know Ben will not agree with this, but I would argue this movie is, if it's not there, it's scratching that surface. It's like maybe last one out, but I think it could, there's a couple things, like cinematography, it might get in, it might do it. It's a really well shot film, but
you got to remember though, Hunter, like the Academy, and I'm sure we'll talk about this in upcoming episodes as we start to make Oscar predictions and we see the nominee list, but it's not purely a group of disinterested academics, right? It's a group of professionals who are in many ways on the fence about the role that Netflix is playing in the industry. You know, a lot of people are seeing it as fresh money and new investment into the industry, but for other companies, it completely undermines what they're doing. It's a, if you know someone who has a theater or you're, you know, in the business of releasing films into theaters as the primary source of revenue, like this is antithetical to what you're doing. So they're the new kids. Yeah, I know, and I'm excited that they're doing it. I see it as new money into the industry, or a fresh perspective and a fresh way of doing it. Because I think the real question with Beast of No Nation that I was left thinking about when it was over, because my brothers and I saw it in Denver at a Landmark theater. This beautiful Mayan theater that, was completely empty. It was the three of us for a screening, and the guy was basically just talking to us like, hey, I'm so glad you came out. And I, like, bought Twizzlers to, you know, give him free money, basically, because I didn't even, like, you know, I was giving him, like, 1,000% markup on a bag of Twizzlers.
The bad part was, like, this is what you think all theaters are like now, because this one experience.
No, but the... It's not my one experience at a theater.
Like, oh, I'm so right. Theaters are so dead. There's no one here.
This is what I was thinking about, though, when I left the theater, is what would this... Okay, imagine that this film, because it didn't crush it at film festivals. It was recognized, and it's been on the list of like an Oscar contender. Mm-hmm. If it had been released in a traditional like indie art house rollout, what would it have really grossed at the box office? Like, without Netflix, we would probably not be talking about this film. Honestly, it would be a footnote of like. I mean, I think it would be in discussion.
I don't know. I mean, I would say you've got Idris Elba riding like the James Bond press wave, plus Cary Fukunaga coming off of like a stellar True Detective season. I think I could say this would be a much different
conversation.
Like, fairly
well. I'm thinking more along the lines of just imagine this. It's a simple thought experiment of the film would still exist. The film had already been made, right? Netflix bought it after it was made. I'm just talking about who takes it and puts it out into the world for people to see. And according, like, what's interesting is Netflix released these articles in the interview saying that 3 million people have streamed it, which is one of the only times we've gotten streaming numbers from Netflix, which to me says they're trying to justify. Official. They've gotten a lot of bad PR about how poorly it's done at the box office, so they're trying to justify it for other films and other creators and investors, like, hey, this is not a losing strategy. But if it wasn't on Netflix, who would have gotten it and what would have done? And I think you guys would have seen it in L.A., maybe you would have seen it in Atlanta, Hunter, at one art house, and it probably would. It's at Living Room Theater here in Portland now. But for the majority of the country, 3 million people would not have seen this film, right? And I think that's where I come from on the view of all this streaming stuff. Is I know it undermines a lot of the existing business models, and it changes the way people make money in Hollywood. But more people saw this film than I think potentially ever could have seen this film. And I think that's exciting because I don't really want to get into the review of the film, but it's an important film. Like, I'm really glad it exists. There's a lot to talk about in the film. There's a whole lot to discuss as far as the way the film goes about what it's doing.
I thought if it was like Hotel Rwanda, but no, it really was. There's a lot of similarities to Hotel Rwanda. Don't you laugh at me. And
I agree.
I think that it in a lot of places it was more darker in almost every way than Hotel Rwanda. But I feel like that's a more accurate representation of what that's probably that life. Like, that's probably pretty close.
Ben, you know, when you got started talking about the Academy and like how just the people in the Academy aren't ready to recognize stuff like this, I just immediately flashed back to like 5 years ago. When like the first nominations for House of Cards started showing up in the Emmys, and everybody was just like, "There's no way the Emmys are ever going to recognize this stuff."
All right.
And now, you know, you've got the point where Netflix and Amazon shows are winning more than anything else, and it's just kind of widely accepted. So it's kind of interesting to think that maybe movies are just like 5 years behind TV.
Yeah, and I would love to be wrong about Beast of No Nation being nominated for something significant. I don't think it will get nominated for anything of significance at the Academies this year. That's just my gut feeling from seeing it. I think it's a great film, but I, you know, just like with House of Cards getting nominated, it's one thing to be nominated, it's another thing to win. I know Transplant won for Amazon with the Emmys. I'm just not sure. I think the Oscars might be different. I don't know the difference in the the voting of both organizations exactly. But it seems like when you look at Oscar predictions and then who wins, there seems to be kind of like an old boy system of like people. I don't know. We can get into that in a future episode. But I'll be really surprised if it gets a significant nomination this year.
I think. If anything, and this is my last argument about this movie. I have one other thing to add after this, but it's just some math that I did a second ago. Okay, so if anything, I was really excited to see Idris Elba's performance in this movie, and it was a good one. It was a good Idris Elba performance. He did a good job. But the one performance that I think deserves to get nominated is Abraham Ada, the kid. Untrained. They found him playing soccer like 2 weeks before they start shooting. At a soccer pitch with a bunch of friends from school. He was, like, ditching school to be out playing soccer. They find him there. He auditioned. Got the role. Is amazing. I mean, absolutely on every level. You will leave that movie depressed, but really, like, hopeful for this kid's future, because he is something. Like, he brings it. And I don't know if he just had no fear going into it, because he just didn't understand, like, what an opportunity this was. But, I mean, he obviously probably understands now. But, okay, so that aside, I did the numbers. It cost $6 million to make the movie. All right? $6 million production budget to shoot the movie. Netflix buys it for $12.
Yeah.
If 3 million people really stream that movie, if you translate that number over into people that watch it in the theater, $45 million. As of right now.
If you were paying, you're saying if they were paying box office prices to see it. Yeah.
If they're paying box office price. Yeah. $45 million. That's a good.
That's an interesting number, actually.
I mean, that's
a great number.
I think from the perspective of Netflix, like I was reading their financials from this past quarter, because it made headlines because investors were disappointed and all these sorts of things. But when you dig into it, like they're not looking at Beasts of No Nation as a opening weekend sort of investment. No. Like, they're buying that film because it's going to sit in their content library for years and years to come.
Yeah. Well, and it's making a statement, you know? If you subscribe to Netflix, you know, it's not just, you know, Friends. We buy important stuff like this, you know?
And that's another thing that Ben brought up like a while ago, was that basically Netflix is creating things to bring you in. So if Beasts of No Nation is the thing you want to see and you can't see it in your theaters, you'll get Netflix just to see it. Or if it's like a new comedy special or whatever, if that's what hooks you, if that's your jam, as Ben says, that's all they want, because they get you invested in they're the long haul, basically. I mean,
I'm 100%. I'm a reformed illegal streamer from high school. I used to just stream everything, like, you know, back in the mega upload days or whatever.
Yeah.
But like, I'm totally reformed, and I'm like a 100%, like, I don't know what you would call it, like a brand whore, not like that, but like, to the point where, you know, when Transparent came out, I had an Amazon Prime subscription because I got it a deal through like my school.
Yeah.
That it was super cheap. So I was doing it for a year to get free shipping. Transparent comes out, I watch it, totally blown away by it. And I still have an Amazon Prime account. I mean, free shipping is nice, but I'm like really proud of the media that they're putting out. So
there's a
keep
show
that
I just saw advertised that I'm super excited about called Man in High Castle.
Yeah, the Ridley Scott show. Yeah. The pilot was really good.
Well, and I think the key thing with this, with the promotion around Beasts of No Nation online, like, I've seen some of the ads that Netflix has been running around on different websites. And it's a really simple sales pitch. It's like, if you are a subscriber, come watch it, because we want you to enjoy the content we have. If you're not a subscriber, sign up today for a free trial and watch the movie for free. Like, that's killer. You know what I mean? Like, I think their subscriber numbers, like, kind of disappointed investors or whatever, because it wasn't as high as they had anticipated. But for the most part, like, they are playing a very, very long game that is not centered around, you know, sign-ups related to just this film. You know, I mean, they want people to join, and people are joining. They're growing substantially, but it's such a long play that I just think is really interesting to pay attention to.
I think it's not only to try to get people in, but also to maintain the people they already have, because they just bumped up the price again. Netflix
by $1. By $1.
Dude, okay, dollars add up, Ben.
And you're grandfathered in. You're grandfathered in if you're an existing user.
Yeah, but
isn't it for a time, though? Isn't it for
it's for
a
year.
And after
it's for a year.
Okay. So you get $12 off. Gotcha.
You're saving $12.
Here's the thing. Here's the thing that boggles my mind. No, Hunter, I know you're making gestures towards your ears. Like, here's the thing. HBO Go, which I subscribe to, or HBO Now, pardon me, $15 a month. Yeah. I've been very close to canceling it multiple times, and then, you know, I'm like, I'm not really going to get rid of it. But $15 a month for that. Hulu Plus, or whatever they're calling it without ads, where it's $12.99 a month, right?
Yeah.
And then we've got YouTube Red now that's coming out. That's $9.99 a month. And
and don't forget Broadway HD just announced today. $14.99 a month.
What?
Stream live and recorded Broadway shows.
West Side Story at work today.
But see, that's actually really interesting, though, from a theater.
Don't want to go stand in line for Book of Mormon?
I mean, yeah, you that's...
Get a Broadway HD.
But see, that's a really interesting topic to bring up, is theater being the whole, like, that's a live performance. Like, it's the big thing is seeing them right in front of you, and it's now streaming online for people to watch.
It all started with that Christopher Walken, Peter Pan. That's where it all started.
Sound of Music was before that.
Yeah, it's not as interesting to talk about as Christopher Walken forgetting his
actually
lines.
No, it kind of it because it had higher ratings and more people.
I don't know. I think it's a kind of cool idea. If you live in, you know, Illinois and you're a Broadway fan, like, you're not, maybe if you're loaded, you make it like once a year and see a couple shows. Yeah. And I mean, the shows are, it's not like there's a production budget. You just got to pay for a camera because the shows are already happening.
Yeah. It does expose a whole new group of people who have never and will never be able to see a live Broadway play to Broadway.
Very much so. And that's really interesting to me. And like being where we're from, I mean, and usually most cities have their art community and have their theater community. I know where we're from, or Hunter and I and Ben lived in Tuscaloosa, and in Birmingham and Alabama, they both have two very large theater communities in those cities. And they don't all, and very few people get to actually just go to New York once a year and see the shows. It's like they listen to it on iTunes and that's about it. Like, they can't actually go watch it.
That's pretty true.
To go off what Ben was saying about having to pay for HBO. Now, here's the thing, Ben. Do you keep it for the original content, or do you keep it for the back catalog on HBO?
Well, and so this is what I keep running in my mind, is I'm curious at my own thought process about this whole thing, right? Is because you rarely hear people, rarely ever do you hear people talk about how expensive HBO is, right? It's never really in discussion. It's like, well, it's just HBO. You're going to pay what you're going to pay. But when Netflix raises their price by a dollar, people are like, those greedy, greedy little Netflix people always raising their prices. Which I just think it's interesting because, I'm not watching the back catalog of HBO, really. I mean, I always think in my mind that I will. I'm like, oh, I'll get back and watch through all of The Sopranos, right? But I haven't done that. Mm. I will probably never do that. But it's like it's a little bit like in economics, just an option to exercise that right. Like, I put a value on the potential that I could do that. Right? It's as strange as that sounds. Like,
let's say hypothetically, it's a rainy day in Portland, and you got nothing going on.
That's it.
You know, you tap into the back catalog or something. It's there. You're paying for to have it there when you want.
I'm curious. I feel like Netflix is getting close, and I think when it happens, we'll just stop talking about it altogether. It'll be an event that just passes by us. But at the point where the back catalog of Netflix is considered a back catalog in the sense that it's not the things. House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, those are still ongoing shows that people are talking about as new seasons coming out and all these things.
Yeah.
But in 5 years, when those shows wrap and they're just sitting on the shelf on the Netflix library, they're not going to be glitzy and glamorous, but I think that some of those shows will add up to be like the back catalog of HBO, and it'll have that same sort of cachet that... allows them to basically keep subscribers for very, very long periods of time, even if they aren't really using it that much. Because it's just that association of like, I might go back and watch BoJack Horseman season 2. I don't know. It's super dark, but I might go back and watch it. You know, I think they're getting enough shows to do that.
It's worth watching
twice.
It's no
Piece of No Nation. Let's get real.
But see, like, once you start adding that list up, and it's going to be pretty long really soon. I put it in the show notes, their list of, they have an entire list of all of their original content for investors.
When they purchase the exclusive rights to, like, British television and run that as original content, like, there's a ton
Black
of that.
Mirror. The watchability of a Black Mirror back catalog, phenomenal. It's basically like a movie each episode.
I'm gonna throw out, I'm still on edge until we get Scrotal Recall season 2.
You
just
would, Thomas.
On that
you would
season
be
two.
A Scrotal Recall fanboy.
It's a very entertaining film. I mean, it's a very entertaining show. It's
Stroke
fun.
Boy, well, Thomas Horton over here.
Well, what I was also too about comparing HBO to Netflix, because that's kind of the big comparison, in all honesty. Yeah. And you're talking about how people aren't, or how Netflix is starting to rack up nominations to the Emmys. Here are the numbers for HBO Emmys compared to everyone else. Primetime Emmy wins this past year for HBO, 14. The next network behind them is Comedy Central for 4. Overall, and Netflix has one win, by the way, compared to HBO's 14. And then overall Emmy wins by network, HBO has 43. The next person is NBC with 12, and Netflix is down at 4.
Interesting.
So that's a very big gap between HBO and Netflix. I mean,
HBO's also had some time advantage.
Yeah, but I mean, it's still. I think, I mean, how many subscribers does HBO now have compared to Netflix?
Yeah, the last time we looked at those numbers, I believe HBO gets to count a whole bunch of people that are international subscribers, that are basically hotel subscribers, as far as my understanding goes. They have a pretty, I think it was up towards 100 million internationally. Domestically, though, I believe that Netflix surpassed HBO in subscribers domestically recently.
Yeah. And I mean, it's the thing is HBO. Why I think that people are willing to pay $15 a month is because HBO from the very beginning set themselves up as a premium network for viewers, and Netflix was more originally started off as just a video rental place, an online video rental place, and that's it. I think that might be why it has some effect. Why people are fine with paying $15 a month for HBO compared to 9 or 10 for Netflix. That's me.
I remember way throwback, someone gave my family like a month of Netflix, or like 3 months of Netflix, I think, for Christmas when it was first starting.
Yeah.
As of like the digital.
Yeah.
Because we were actually, another throwback, we were actually Blockbuster mail subscribers.
Oh man.
Wow.
Which was a solid system. It was a solid program because my family likes watching classic films a lot, so we could order that stuff that they wouldn't have in the Blockbuster.
Yeah.
But anyway, like somebody gave us Netflix for like 3 months, and like my dad and I were so excited, and we got on and just like started like combing through, and like we found like A-Team, like the A-Team series, and that was like the only thing of note on like the entire Netflix streaming at that point. It was just like stuff you hadn't heard of, public domain movies.
Yeah.
And it was miserable, and we probably wouldn't have kept it if someone hadn't like gifted it to us.
I was in 7th grade. I went out to the mailbox, and for some reason Netflix had sent our address a copy of The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Since that day I've been a Netflix subscriber. I don't know why they sent it to us. I don't know how. I don't know why. But they got me, and they've had me ever since.
Oh, man.
It's true. It's the weirdest. I still don't know why it was there.
But see, here's a question to bring. I know Thomas and I have talked about this, and that's the accessibility of old films in this age of streaming. Is that movies that you just go rent at a video store or however you do it, you can't do that now because of all the licensing agreements that Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or whoever have. And that's, I think, a topic to discuss, is that certain movies that are considered classics, you can't just go view anymore. So to a regular consumer or whatever, does that really exist to them if they don't have a real way of getting it in their eyes?
Yeah, I mean,
well, I think that goes towards something, Brandon, you and I have talked about, like, we've turned into a culture of not, like, what do I want to watch, but what can I watch?
Yeah.
You know? Definitely. I still do, and I know most of, like, those of us in kind of this film community do, but, like, a lot of people I know, you don't, like, sit down to watch a movie with a movie in mind. You sit down to see, like, what's available.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think what's going to be interesting will be the Apple TV rollout and the ability for a studio to come in and have their own direct release platform and basically cut out the middleman. And I think that might be the way this thing moves forward, in all honesty.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
that's the way I'm thinking it's going to happen. But
yeah, I think that Broadway HD deal we were just talking about is a really interesting example of, you have the potential for some of these really smaller markets, like Turner Classics could have a channel now on the new Apple TV that you pay $5 a month, you know, whatever it is, they pick a number, and it'll be substantially more money than they would ever make as a cable channel. And that's what's so interesting. Everyone's been, all the TV networks have been afraid of the unbundling of cable, the collapse of the cable revenues that they've been used to, because they've been at historic highs for the amount of money that they get to make off of it. But when you really, like, I was doing the math the other day, it's like, okay, I don't have cable. I don't pay Comcast a dime other than for internet, right? But I have HBO Now, Netflix, Hulu Plus, Amazon because of the free shipping, and what's the other thing that we subscribe to? I don't even know. Like, I'm paying more than if I just had cable. Now, like, it's just the world we live in, but as more of these services, like a Turner Classic Movie, or, oh, I have Sling TV for college football. That's another $30 a month, right? So that's basically cable. But, like, you know, Comedy Central, they don't have it now. You still have to have a subscription to a cable package, or ESPN. But when they unbundle, when ESPN's available for $10 a month, like, bam, it's over.
Yeah.
Like, I just pay ESPN directly. Yeah. And then the same for all these other services. And ESPN will make more money at $10 a month directly than they make through a cable package.
Yep, because they're not having to share that revenue with anyone. They're not having to pay anyone. It's all through them. And then I think they're seeing that. And I think what you're seeing is the digital age finally coming to a head with the way that we've known TV forever. I think that is going to change. I think it's already begun to change. I think the idea of being able to almost pick your own cable plan to the things that you actually watch, and not all the crap you pay for but you don't actually watch, I think that is the way that society is now. I don't think people are starting to, they're seeing like, oh, well, if I can just pay to watch what I want to watch and pay this much money compared to paying this much money and then not actually watching half the things that I'm paying for, why am I doing that? It just doesn't make any, consumer-wise, it doesn't make any sense when you sit down and think about it. And now we're getting to the point where the generation that understands how to make this stuff happen and actually do these things and work these apps and everything, that generation is getting old enough to make these decisions. That's when the change is going to come. The baby boomers, it's the shift from the baby boomer generation into this next one.
This is an interesting thing that I almost think is another topic sometime in the future. But I feel like when we talk about this unbundling of things, like, you know, like if ESPN had just a direct payment or something like that, right, their own channel. This is exactly like the Netflix situation, where it's premium content. We're talking about big names with big brands that can just go straight to people's checkbooks or their credit cards or whatever and make more money than they make now. But what I think is interesting, when you, the other end of the spectrum is YouTube Red, where they're trying desperately to find ways to make more money than one of the articles I put in the show notes is Hank Green wrote an article on Medium about, you know, basically, you know, he's got billions of views, but when it all shakes out, basically you make about $2 per 1,000 views on YouTube. So you make about 2 cents per view, right? And so this YouTube Red Play is an effort to try and raise that number. But, you know, that's its own thing to talk about. But what's interesting is you kind of have this gulf in the middle that's forming. You're talking about the crap on cable that people don't want to watch. But really, like, there's a lot of people who have jobs because of mediocre television. You know, let's be honest. Like, there's a whole lot of people who work in Hollywood today or work in Atlanta or Louisiana or, you know, New Mexico or Portland. Yeah, or all over the country, who are working on shows that pull in mediocre ratings that basically break even barely, but they're filling up a time slot on a network or a cable channel, a premium cable channel. And when those no longer have a home, when they can't negotiate with Netflix to get a substantial amount of money because they're not an Oscar contender or a big name production company, they're going to be left with what? Like, they're not going to be able to go to cable because cable revenue is declining. We've passed peak cable a couple years ago. So they're going to be left in a really difficult situation. And I'm just curious.
Just explain the Mindy Project.
Well, I just think it's interesting. For as much as I'm excited about the changes and the how it's bringing better content, I'm not excited for the way that it's changing the industry for
the little guy.
And the ladder that I think is going to be forming around, you're either going to be fighting it out in the potential, I don't want to call it a cesspool, but in the lower levels of the YouTube world or Vimeo or something, trying to put together some sort of like indie existence, and you're hoping for just this big shot to go up to directing a Star Wars film or some big studio project. It seems difficult to, other than these prestige films, you know, there is this gulf forming around, yeah, the kind of everyday grind of some of these projects that keeps a lot of people in the game, that keeps them making film and television.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ben, you know, something, when you were talking about the little guy, something I've noticed, and it kind of goes back to when I was talking about we've turned into like a what can I watch culture as opposed to what should I watch, is something I've been finding with a lot of my friends and family back home. Is there, and I don't think this monetizes at all for the filmmakers, but it, Netflix, the for some indie films that like Netflix does pick up, they do infinitely better than they would, you know, getting passed around on a DVD. For instance, some that I know of that like everyone that I know has seen, that I don't think like would, like Spectacular Now, I don't think would have made it if it hadn't have been on Netflix. Especially a big one, like I got right when Frank got added to Netflix, I got so many texts from people that were like, hey, what's the deal with Frank? This looks interesting. Should I watch it? I love Frank. I said, like, absolutely. But, like, that, I don't think Frank would have ever done any. I mean, it was publicly funded by, Ireland and Wales? It was, and, like, I mean, yeah, it had Fassbender, but he had a mask over his head the whole time. And Scoot McNairy isn't necessarily, like, box office gold at all. Like,
yeah, I think I'm with you. Like, I think more people are getting to see more films than ever before. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's so exciting about Netflix and all these other players being in the game, that films like that can find viewers. The question is... Some of those films.
Some films.
Yeah, and the thing that's hard to understand as a creator is, like, how do I get that Netflix deal, right? It's not really in your control. Exactly. It's not a marketplace. They're a buyer. That's all it is. Like, all these different content streaming companies are just buyers you're hoping to get a chance to maybe be on. But the thing that's troubling is we don't get a lot of information out about what kind of money you get back as a creator on some of these indie projects that get picked up. And it sounds like from a lot of the articles I've seen, these people who are at film festivals get offers from Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or whatever. And it's not necessarily a feeding frenzy. It's more like we're just kind of hoping to get it out somewhere. You know, that's the loose language they use. And that doesn't sound like a really healthy market. That sounds like people who are aiming to maybe make another film.
Well, there's not really a way to, like, once you're on Netflix, there's not really a super way to, like, market, like, watch this on Netflix.
Okay, so I just want to raise a point. Ben, you're saying that Netflix is a great way for people to see some films that they normally wouldn't be able to see because you can't see a great indie movie all the time like you used to be able to in a theater. But you're also arguing that Netflix and Hulu and these things are basically changing the way that bottom-of-the-barrel average television shows are slowly going to die? So you're saying that you'll be able to watch more indie films, but the shows that you might be your guilty pleasure that aren't really prestige television shows are dying because of the thing that you're being able to watch an indie film on. It's an interesting thing. It's like...
So are you basically, you're saying we're becoming what's the word?
It's a double-edged sword.
We're being accustomed to actually, I guess, higher not higher quality, but higher praise thing or content.
Well, everyone wants to be watching the thing everyone's talking about.
I think we're we just said that movies are 5 years behind TV, but I think in this sense TV is behind in that years ago the middle studio film died. The middle studio film is dead. And
Steve Jobs.
And I think TV is still going on.
I wouldn't call Steve Jobs your success story here, Hunter, as far as money.
No, it's not my success story. I was proving a point.
Okay.
What about Straight Outta Compton? Trainwreck. What about those?
Selma.
Straight Outta Compton. Okay.
Yeah, Straight Outta Compton was like.
But I mean, for the most, yeah. I'm not saying it's a it's a law.
Yeah.
But it's just we're not seeing that trend anymore. Like you can't really count.
I'm with Thomas on this big time, and I like your analogy because it's perfect because it represents like people have to choose each film they go see. They individually select a film and they say, "I'm going to go see Steve Jobs. I'm going to go see Trainwreck." And I saw Trainwreck in theaters for those who are doubting among the group. But the thing is, with television, it's been locked into this cable bundle that people don't choose and people still pay, and that is a good thing. Yes, people are going to see more positive things, but for companies like Viacom, which owns a whole bunch of networks, right? Comedy Central, MTV, like you go down a really long list, a lot of consolidation in the media companies in America. It's a different topic. But they had to write down their back catalog of reality television shows on their asset sheet. This was like 6 months ago or something like that, because they were kind of anticipating that they could just run Keeping Up with the Kardashians forever on, one of their networks. But it's just not getting the same viewing numbers that they thought it would. And they blamed Netflix and they blamed a lot of these other options for viewers. Like, why go watch an old reality TV? Housewives of whatever, from season 3 is just not that interesting when you can point and click and watch anything. That's just not at the top of the barrel.
This is my prediction now, bold prediction, that this is the time we will see the beginnings of a real-life Truman Show.
maybe.
Clears throat, backs away from Mike.
I want to bring this back up because you're going back of saying the mid-budget film is dead. And I actually, to some extent, I do agree. But I do want you to look at Universal and what they're doing, because a lot of their films, besides, say, Jurassic World, if you're at Furious 7, are fairly mid-budget movies, and they're making a killing. Like, for example, I'm just going to bring it up, 50 Shades of Grey cost $40 million to make.
Well, they didn't have a lot of costumes to make for that.
True, but I'm saying $40 million, it made close to $600 million worldwide. Unfriended, $1 million, $63 million worldwide. I mean, they're Pitch Perfect, Trainwreck, Straight Outta Compton, cost $28 million production budget, made $200 million. Like, they're Universal is what.
But also, I don't know. None of those are. I don't know how to word this. None of those are. Those are all kind of, I don't want to say sure things, but like, I mean, Judd Apatow brings Amy Schumer to you. You don't turn it down. Right. Elizabeth Banks says, let's do Pitch Perfect 2, Pitch Perfect 1, made an insane amount of money.
When
you don't
Danny
turn
Boyle,
it down.
These are not risky
Danny
calls.
And
I agree.
Aaron Sorkin bring you Michael Fassbender and Jeff Daniels and Seth Rogen. You would argue the same thing, but obviously you're wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I say Universal, I think, knows what they're doing. Or let me phrase. They're doing it right by keeping their budgets low and producing the films they're producing. And so I think for them, the mid-budget hasn't died. Elsewhere, I agree completely. And they're putting like millions and millions of dollars into films that are just trying to draw audience. I'm just saying.
They're also able to do this because they have Jurassic Worlds.
Oh yeah, I agree with that too. And Furious 7 or Furious series, I agree. But I just wanted to state that it could come back, but I think right now mostly everywhere else it is dead. But with Universal,
Yeah, and I think it would be great if it came back, because so many of the films that I love from college and high school are mm-hmm. those mid-budget comedies and the mid-budget dramas that became the prestige pictures. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see the list of nominees yeah. this year for drama and for best actor and things like that. But it seems like the bell curve is shifting down, like with some of these Universal examples of, you know, what might have been $40 million before is $20 million now or less. I mean, it's kind of shocking that Fifty Shades of Grey is that small a production budget when, yeah. I mean, they knew, I mean, like the difference between Fifty Shades of Grey and Steve Jobs, people know what you're going to go see when you go to watch Fifty Shades of Grey. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
So it didn't have trouble marketing that film.
No, they did. They didn't. But I'm saying some of the films that have failed miserably for Universal have been low budgets compared to, say, Disney releasing Tomorrowland or John Carter and it tanking. I mean, Universal just released Jim and the Holograms this past weekend. $5 million production budget, it made $1.4 million. I mean, it's a failure, but is it the same failure as, say, Tomorrowland? I mean,
no,
it's not.
No, Tomorrowland is like a potential tentpole failure, impending doom on the world level failure. If Jurassic World had not come out and just destroyed everything in its path like a rampaging T-Rex, then I think that we would be having a much different conversation about Universal right now.
Yeah. So I'm gonna add one more thing, because we started with what you guys have been watching. What are some recommendations for things that are out there that you guys would tell our audience to go watch or go see or something like that, or suggest? Because, like, Thomas suggested Love and Mercy a few weeks ago, and I went and saw it and loved it. I think that's also a very interesting take on the biopic genre with how they use John Cusack and Paul Dano as Brian Wilson. I thought it was really great. Watch out for Dano when it comes to Oscar season, because he's getting, and even Elizabeth Banks, both are getting a lot of buzz for their performances. But yeah, let's go down the row of you guys suggesting some stuff. So, Ben?
I mean, I'm gonna say Beasts of No Nation, just because very few people saw it in theaters and only 3 million people have seen it on Netflix so far. I mean, that leaves a lot of potential listeners out there who haven't seen it. I think it's a problematic subject matter that I've been thinking a lot about since I saw it. But I think it's it's potentially, you know, if it is rated R for many obvious reasons after you see the film. But, you know, I think it's worth being a part of the conversation while people are talking about it now. If there's anything that I think we'll miss about this shift towards streaming, not to take a side rant again here, is that there is something really nice about a big weekend opening, and we all get to talk about it. We all get to talk about the Star Wars film over the Christmas break and New Year's this holiday. And with Beasts of No Nation, like, if it wasn't in theaters and it didn't get all this press, you know, like, 3 million people would see it scattered out over the course of months. And so I would ask you guys, hey, have you seen Beasts of No Nation? Be like, it's in my queue. Haven't really seen it. Probably never will, honestly. And I think that's, if there's anything I love about film, it's the chance to talk about things with people and for it to spark conversation. So anyway, see Beasts of No Nation while we're all talking about it, and then tweet at us. I'd love to potentially talk about it later.
Yeah, while we're talking about Netflix, I'm going to mention something that's been out for a while but actually just made it to Netflix, which is kind of surprising, because I never thought this would ever be on Netflix. Kung Fury, ladies and gentlemen, is now on Netflix. And okay, I'm just going to say, if we're talking about streaming, we're talking about something that literally out of nowhere blew up from a Kickstarter onto a YouTube internet sensation. I mean, this is literally internet gold. This is YouTube gold. You can watch it for free on YouTube. Kung Fury, one of the guy who made Kung Fury is a Swedish dude, made it in his basement in his office with green screens. It is something that, get on the bandwagon now, because this guy is doing things. This is going to be something that you're going to remember one day and be like, wow, that's where he started and look where we're at now. I'm telling you now.
I love that this is two episodes in a row that Hunter's recommendation has been has been drunk here.
And you know what? I don't even feel bad because it's true. It's so true.
Oh, I know. I forced so many people to sit down and watch it this summer, and they were just like, "Why am I watching this 30-minute YouTube video?" And I was
true.
Like, "Just wait."
It's
not my jam. Like not my jam
at man.
All. It jams. Oh, man. I jam. My current recommendation is can I do season 2 of Fargo? Because I'm sure, really enjoying it. Even if you haven't watched season 1, which I highly recommend, I might be enjoying season 2 even more. But it's kind of anthologized. It's a prequel, so like it won't ruin season 1 to watch season 2 right now. But if you're any kind of Coen Brothers fan, you need to be watching this show, because it's not just like a spinoff of Fargo the movie. Like the creator sets out every season to pay homage to 3 Coen Brothers movies. So the first season it was Fargo, A Serious Man, and No Country for Old Men. And this season it's Fargo, Miller's Crossing, and The Man Who Wasn't There. So it's got a very interesting shooting style. It's set in the 70s. They're doing a lot of work with like multiple screens and like cross cutting. And the cast is just awesome. You got Ted Danson, Patrick Wilson, Gene Smart, Jeffrey Donovan, Brad Garrett, and Kieran Culkin with a really great, I think, breakout dramatic role for him. I mean, he's been a great actor on the sidelines for a while, but this shows he's got a lot of potential. So yeah, check it out. It's fun. It feels... I wouldn't be raving about this show as much if it didn't really feel like a Coen Brothers like movie. It feels like you're watching a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah, he's done a good job at capturing that magic, because that's kind of difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
Something is just unique as that world is that they make is just, I don't know. And I've heard a lot of good things about the new season. I haven't watched an episode yet. I was a big fan of the first season. Colin Hanks in particular, I thought did a great job. But I've heard this season, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people in this new season too. It's a really...
Yeah, I didn't even bring up Kirsten Dunst or Matt Damon.
Yeah, Matt Damon's in there. He's in everything.
Jesse
Plemons.
He's
literally in everything now. You can't...
Bridget Spies. He's in Bridget Spies.
He's in Black Mass.
But on that note, too, also, I recommend, because it's about to go off Netflix, and that's Fargo, the movie, is about to go off Netflix.
Wow.
Also, a few others that are about to go off Netflix, Blues Brothers, which is my favorite film of all time. And also, Stand By Me is another movie about to go off Netflix. And let's see, Scream, if you want a good horror film coming out for Halloween.
Who did they lose these to?
I don't know. It's a
what
great question.
Deal is this in? This is not.
Every time they sign a deal, it's dated with an expiration date, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it goes to HBO. It just goes back to the rights holder.
Yeah. Well, and then also go see Steve Jobs in theaters, but let's wrap it up real quick. Is that follow us? Make sure you follow us on medium.com. Look at the stuff that we're posting, articles.
Yeah,
and
brand
stuff.
new review today from Anna Catley.
From Anna Catley, and then Ben's gonna release something soon. Gonna drop something.
That was big.
And then it's big. It's big time. Also, too, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Cinenation Show, and for our Bad Movie Book Club Twitter is Bad Movie Nation, and we're doing I Know Who Killed Me coming up soon. Make sure you follow us on or like us on Facebook. And make sure you subscribe on iTunes. And soon we'll be prepping for a new filmography episode as well. So get ready for that. It's been a year since we've been doing this. Ben and I have been doing it and then brought on Hunter and Thomas. This is like the year anniversary. That's why I returned to this topic of streaming. And so the fans that have listened since then, we thank you. And hopefully you continue to listen.
Thank you.
So until next time, bye.